Hello, and welcome everybody to session 8 of our Care Partner Training Program. Once again, I am Polly Dawkins, Executive Director of the Davis Finney Foundation, and I am thrilled to welcome our very special guest, Sarah Chen. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Polly. Thanks for having me.
Super. Today, we are going to talk about navigating the healthcare system, Medicare, and patient and care partner support. Let's get started. Welcome. And I would love to introduce you to our audience. Could you tell us a bit about who you are and the role that you have played on Dr. Jori Fleischer's research team and the experience that you've had around navigating healthcare systems in general?
Of course. So like you said, my name is Sarah Chen. I'm a master's prepared licensed clinical social worker, and I've been working at Rush for the past 10 years, and with our movement disorders clinic where Dr. Fleischer works for the almost the past 9 years. So have become pretty familiar with some of the struggles and, you know, unique symptoms and needs of this population. I'm part of a palliative care clinic that's embedded within our movement disorders clinic at Rush, and I'm also a part of a research project that Dr. Fleischer is in the process of developing. So I wear several hats. Prior to joining Rush, I worked in a long-term care facility for 5 years. I know I don't look old enough to have been working for almost 15 years, but I bring a lot of experiences, specifically working with older adults, their care partners, and people kind of navigating chronic illness. So it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for your commitment to our community.
Of course. You know, navigating health systems is such a struggle. So it's always, you know, trying to help people figure out how they get their needs met and what's the best way to go about doing that. So hopefully today we can cover a few of those things.
Oh, let's dive into that a bit. So when you think about the years of experience you've had working in the Parkinson's community, both with people with Parkinson's and their families and care partners, tell us a bit about some of the biggest challenges that families face as it relates to the healthcare system.
Yeah. You know, some of the bigger challenges can be just even navigating medication and how they manage what can become a pretty complex medication regimen, navigating changes as someone's condition changes. It's the care partners are also then navigating how do we adjust to these either new symptoms or new circumstances, you know, managing home safety, how can someone stay at home? How do we maintain our house to be safe, or what do we need to think about? And if we need to make some modifications, you know, how do we go about getting equipment or, you know, even getting someone to come in and take a look at the house? And even one of the biggest questions or concerns I often hear from people is thinking about then how do we bring in help? How do we know when it's time, or how do we know when it's time to make a transition?
Mm-hmm. Wow, those are big topics.
You know.
And you, in your role, do you handle all of those topics, or do you have other people you call in and lean on to help with some of those topics?
Yeah, I think that often what I end up doing and many kind of clinic-based social workers do is we help people navigate through some of those questions. And, you know, I can help specifically work with families as they think through some of these things. And then I can refer them or know of people in the community of, you know, if you need a home safety evaluation, here are people where we can go, you can connect with, or here's how we think about how much help you might need or when you need it. And here are then resources in the community to begin exploring. So a lot of it is kind of the groundwork or foundation and then helping to point people in the right direction. So I am not the expert in knowing how wide your doorways need to be, but I can help you find someone who can better assess that.
So that would be maybe an occupational therapist that you'd
exactly. Yeah. And there's many that specialize in doing home safety evaluations, and that you can get it even covered by the insurance. And so we can, you know, that's where a social worker can help you navigate through some of that. Even the clinic nurses, as they do this, are become more and more familiar with it as well. So
to review, so the things you talked about, that the challenges that you see is medication management, navigating care partner, changing roles or the changing roles of a care partner, home safety, how to get medical equipment and devices, and then how to transition to long-term care or when to transition to long-term care. So as you think about those things, are there any stories that from your experience that jump out to you in terms of those, somebody who had a particular challenge that you had to navigate through or on any of those topics?
Yeah, I think about, I think about even something as what might feel as simple as getting durable medical equipment. Like we, you know, maybe someone is starting to need a walker or a wheelchair and they're not sure where to start. So they've bought something out of pocket or they, you know, got a piece of equipment. But then in talking with us as on the team, we realized they got a basic wheelchair, which is covered by the insurance and potentially can be a good fit. But, you know, really they wanted the wheelchair to be able to get in and out of the trunk to take in the community. And the standard heavy wheelchair is like 60 pounds and not really feasible for the care partner to be lugging in and out of a trunk. And so it's some of those instances where, you know, we can help guide families to say, what is it that you're really looking for? Like, or, and then figure out what's the best equipment. Or do you want to try, like, a tub bench might be ideal in the shower, but we don't know exactly if it's going to work for your setup because everyone's setup is so different. So maybe let's borrow something from a nurse's lending closet. Here's where you could find a nurse's lending closet in your community. Borrow something, see if it works, you know, and then if it doesn't, okay, so you just borrowed something, we take it back and we try something else versus, you know, spending the money to purchase something and then have it not work. So, you know, thinking the equipment feels like it would be like a simpler thing, but can, you know, a little bit of a conversation or some planning on the back end can be helpful. Even with medication management, as someone's symptoms may increase or, you know, they need their medication more frequently, well, then how do we're not designed to be able to, you know, have an alarm system internally to know every 3 hours to remember to take your pills. So, you know, what resources are available? How can we use an alarm medication dispenser to set that up? Or how can we set alarms like on the phone, or you know, what resources can we utilize so that the care partner isn't, you know, owning or having to keep track of everything all on their own or have someone missing doses regularly. So yeah, it's some of those conversations.
So all of these things that you're talking about really seem like they impact a person and a care partner's quality of life.
They really do. They really do.
Can you talk about that a little bit, the connection?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things is that quality of life, it can be an impact of like physical changes that can impact quality of life. There can also be kind of this perceived idea that quality of life has changed, that because I have this new thing that's affecting me, it means I can't do X, Y, Z. And often, you know, in the palliative care clinic where I work at Rush, we were spending a lot of time thinking about how can we maximize quality of life. And what might feel like small changes to address symptoms can really have a bigger impact than, you know, it might seem on their own. So if someone's in, you know, being really bothered by constipation, or they're losing weight, or we're struggling at a certain time of day, you know, thinking through or troubleshooting some of those specific things can really then have a much larger impact, because maybe we're not struggling so much with the constipation and we get a better bowel regimen, well, then maybe we're feeling better and we're able, our medication works better. We're able to go get out and about and we're able to do more because we're feeling better. And, you know, if you thought about just attributing like, oh, it's just my constipation, like it really can have a larger impact. I don't mean to focus so much on constipation, but it's something that often patients struggle with and their families struggle with, and they don't always connect it to the illness. You know, palliative care can really be helpful to families even thinking about what comes next, or how do we anticipate, or how do we know what to expect? And that, again, can kind of relate to quality of life, of thinking about, well, what do we need, or when do we decide it's time to do something different? And if you have a little better idea of kind of what to expect going forward, it can help. It can sometimes help patients and families then make a decision about, okay, if I sort of anticipate this thing maybe then coming down the road, we don't exactly know when or what it will look like, but this is kind of the progression of how things happen. If that's maybe what we might anticipate seeing next, well, then how can we be a little more proactive and not be responding or reacting to the crisis, but maybe being able to be a little more proactive, and feel like they have a little more control over what's to come or how they respond.
You know, you bring up palliative care. I was going to ask you this a little bit later, but I think it's important to help our audience understand what is palliative care and how does that differentiate from hospice care?
That is a great question. And for so many people, it can get lumped together and they really are two distinct things. Palliative care is an overarching umbrella that, like I was mentioning, focuses on quality of life, maximizing, understanding someone's wishes and preferences for care, and then helping someone think through, does a treatment or a decision kind of align with those wishes and preferences? And also can help with providing some of that anticipatory guidance. Hospice is a small piece of palliative care that's focused on end of life, and maximizing someone's quality of life at end of life. So focusing on comfort is a big piece. Hospices benefit, palliative care and hospice are a benefit to patients and their families. It can really have a big impact for families, care partners, as well as patients. Hospice, you do have to have a physician certify that you would have 6 months or less to live. That being said, no one has a crystal ball. You know, they're looking at symptoms and kind of would that trajectory look like that. But we have a lot of folks on hospice care that with a little TLC, they do so well on hospice and end up graduating back off of hospice because they've done so phenomenally well. So, you know, it can be a really helpful benefit. And, you know, sometimes people think, like, when do we start palliative care? Palliative care could start at the time of a diagnosis because there could be a lot of adjustment of sort of understanding diagnosis, understanding what does this mean, understanding progression of symptoms and responding to that. That's all within like a palliative care philosophy. So starting, you know, it's all individual and what people feel comfortable with, but potentially starting it earlier than you might think at face value.
Yeah. If you don't have something like that, you know, you don't have a rush clinic near you or you're not near a large institution, how do you imagine that somebody in our audience could piece together a palliative care approach for them, for themselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's home-based palliative care. So a lot of organizations will provide both hospice and palliative care. So don't be scared off if hospice isn't in the name. Palliative care is also a part of what they offer, where it can, you know, it's in the community, it can come to your home. as well as you can find palliative care providers on the International Neuropalliative Care Society. You can look up physicians who are palliative care trained, as well as the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Care Providers. I can't quite remember the acronym, but I can get it to Mel and we'll make sure it's in the resources at the end. But there's ways that you can find providers all over the country. And even your primary care physician or your local neurologist may be able to recommend a palliative care provider in the community as well.
And the big question many people will probably ask is this covered?
Oh, as soon as you started, I was like, I didn't mention that. Yes, it's covered. It's covered by your insurance. Hospice and palliative care are covered by Medicare and the majority of commercial and state funded programs. You will need a referral potentially from a provider, at least for hospice care for sure. Palliative care, you can often kind of refer yourself in, but it would be covered by the insurance the same way other medical appointments are covered.
Super. Thank you for that. Let's go back to understanding the healthcare system that we in the United States, we have many people watching from outside of the United States, but we'll be focusing on sort of the healthcare system here. Can you help us understand a couple of definitions? So for example, what is in-home care?
Sure. So there are in-home care, I think some of the struggle is that so many of these things go by lots of different names. In-home care is often private duty caregivers that then either are coming from a state program. So depending on your state, it's called different things, but often under the umbrella of maybe like a Department of Aging or Department of Family Services, or through a private pay agency where you're paying for care a certain number of hours, a certain number of days a week, or you found an individual on your own and you're paying that person directly to provide care. If you're a veteran, you also may be eligible for services through the VA and their system of services and supports for veterans and spouses of veterans. So you can also potentially get some in-home help through the VA as well. And this is different from what is called home health care. I didn't come up with names. We should be calling these names something very different so it's less confusing. Home health care is something that is a skilled benefit through the insurance. It's for people who are often either recently been hospitalized and need a little extra support as they're transitioning home from a hospitalization, or in a nursing home for rehab, and again, needing help with that transition home, or need a tune-up, have kind of been at home. Maybe they had things have just declined a little bit. It was winter, we're not getting out as much, and so we need some additional physical, occupational, speech therapy, a nurse that can come to the home, and potentially a bath aid. And so that's ordered by a physician. It's time limited. It's covered by the insurance, which is why you want the physician's order, and covered by Medicare and commercial insurance and most state-funded programs. It's the time limited. It's usually 6 to 8 weeks that they'll come, a couple times a week, depending on how someone is making progress and sort of what the needs are. But unfortunately, we know that someone would benefit from kind of ongoing physical therapy to help maintain. Unfortunately, the programs aren't designed that way. So we usually have to have a break in services for about 3 months before we can ask for a new order for home health to come back out. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
As mud?
Well, yes, because so you've got in-home care and then you've got home health care. In-home care sounds like you can take advantage of state programs or the VA, and those might be covered, or private pay where you're actually paying somebody yourself.
Yes. And the distinction, which I was not clear about, is that when you have an in-home caregiver, They're probably helping with you with some of the self-care things around the house day to day to help you continue to be functioning as well as you can and helping your, like, help your household continue to run. And so that can look like a whole bunch of different things depending on what your needs are. It might be that you have someone come in the morning to help you get up and dressed and, like, going for the day, because mornings are a little bit more difficult. Or, and maybe they're helping you, you know, run the vacuum, change the sheets, you know, get a meal together. You kind of can determine what it is that you need help with based on kind of a whole myriad of factors, what's going on. Whereas, and so that's the home in-home care. They're doing helping with self-care, helping with things around the house. Whereas home health care is more rehabilitation. They're focusing on getting you moving, helping with, you know, your walking, with your strength, with your mobility, maybe hand, using your hands, things like that.
Yeah. So it sounds like the in-home care option, if you have that estate program that's covered, or you have the ability to pay for it, that could be really helpful for care partners.
Yes.
Sounds like daily tasks could be taken off of the care partner's shoulders.
It can be a huge help. Because, you know, from my experience talking to care partners, they end up taking on, you as a care partner end up kind of gradually taking on more and more of the household tasks of everything that goes into running a house. From, you know, mowing the front lawn, to paying all the bills, to grocery shopping and meal preparation, and the list goes on and on. Like, that is just the tip of the iceberg. And that leaves very little time for care partners, for them to, you know, go to their own doctor's appointments or have a social life or do anything that's important to them as well. And not to mention, if as a care partner, you're also trying to work or raise a child or, you know, anything else like that. So in-home help, this private duty caregiver that can come in, can really take a lot off of, or shift some of the things off of a caregiver's plate onto a hired caregiver, that then allows the family caregiver time to go to work and not be worried that, you know, what's my loved one? What's going on with my loved one at home while I'm at work? Or I joke about it in clinic, but I think it's very much a reality, kind of the supermarket dash that, like, how much time can I leave my loved one home alone? Okay, I've got 45 minutes to go to the grocery store. Like, how fast can I get through the aisles to get what I need and get home so that I know that my loved one is still okay? Well, what would it be like if you had a caregiver there and you could go to the grocery store, like run a bunch of errands and not be worried that you're going to come home to find that your loved one got into some mischief and, you know, needed to go to the bathroom and what ensued after that? You know, I don't want that for anyone. So.
Would you remind us again the names of the state agencies that somebody might look at to see if those are available for them?
So a great resource is what's called the Elder Care Locator. It's through the federal government. You can Google Elder Care Locator. You search by your zip code, and it's going to tell you the name of the program for your specific state. So then it will tell you who to contact. So for most of the aging programs, it's probably going to be an area agency on aging, and it will tell you the number and who to call. And you can talk to an intake coordinator there and say, I'm interested in learning about caregiver programs. Does my state offer any? Do I or my loved one qualify? Tell me more. And if you don't qualify, do you have a list of agencies where I could contact to potentially find a private pay caregiver? Would be a great place to start.
And qualify would be based on your income?
Yes. Often it's based on income, assets, and they are also, for many of the programs, they're looking at, like, do you physically need the help? Mm-hmm. So that someone who maybe would just like the help but doesn't necessarily need the help may not qualify. I don't anticipate that's anyone in this audience, but they are looking at, you know, physically, does someone need the assistance as well?
You know how much Medicare would cover? So if you don't qualify for the low income program, do you know what Medicare covers for in-home care?
Well, that's a really great common question we get, Polly. Medicare does not cover in-home caregivers. The Medicare program, the health insurance that many seniors 65 and over or people with disabilities are on, is designed to be a medical insurance, but it unfortunately does not cover in-home care. So that's why we end up with these kind of piece together programs and why it is such a challenge for people to piece together help in the community, because it's really messy to figure out what you qualify for in your program or in your area and what that's called. And so I just want to affirm for everyone who's listening on this call that it is a challenge. It's so hard to know what you qualify for and how you find it.
We have a question from William. He asks, can a client have both home health care and in-home care at the same time?
They absolutely can. Yes. That's a great question.
Super. All right. Well, I could spend the next half hour. We only have another half hour together. We could on these topics, but there are so many others that we'd like to touch on. Can you tell us a little bit about, we've talked about in-home care, we've talked about home health care. Tell us a little bit about sort of the next step, which is sort of long-term care or moving into assisted living, and what does that mean? When would somebody think about that?
Yeah. So there's long-term care. We're going to talk about this. There's a couple different levels. Assisted living is kind of the, you have an apartment, you're still probably able to get yourself dressed and get yourself down to a dining room. You might have a studio or one bedroom kind of apartment, but you're going to get help with some specific tasks. Generally, those would be meals, whether it's two or three meals a day in a common dining room. You'll get help with a shower a couple times a week, and you'll get help with housekeeping. And then you may be able to kind of a la carte purchase some additional help. So that might be help from the assisted living facility nurse who sets up your pillbox every week, or medication reminders that one of the aides in the facility then comes and knocks on your door and says, hey, Sarah, it's time for you to take your pills. You might get escorts to activities. Like, every facility is a little different. They have their kind of a la carte services. But you're still, someone's still generally fairly independent, but they don't, there's a lot of reasons why someone may choose to stay in their home or go into long-term care. There is no right or wrong way. Everyone's situation is so different, and everyone feels very differently about that decision as well. So off the top, I want to say that there is no one way to do this. And as you sort of think through, individuals want to think about, you know, again, what's most important to them. I hear from folks that say, like, I don't want to be a burden to XYZ, my kids, my spouse, my, you know, my neighbors, whoever. I'm going to, you know, I don't want to have the responsibility to take care of this house anymore when it's really hard for me to do it on my own. So I'm going to make a move into an assisted living facility where I live alone and it's really lonely and I miss community. I miss people to talk to at my meals. You know, I don't want to be home alone all the time. Great. Like, then finding a community that's going to be a good fit for them, you know, might make the most sense. For other people, they say, my grandma was in a facility. You know, I never want to be in a facility. Okay, so then how do we try to make your current situation as safe and supported as possible? So when people think about assisted living, you know, wanting to make sure that is faith important to them, or a specific religion, is dietary options most important? Are activities most important? Is it important that the facility has different levels of care so that if you need more care in the future, you can stay within the same community but kind of transition between levels of care? Or you want nothing to do with that and you just want to be in an assisted living? It's so nuanced for everyone's situation. The one thing to think about with assisted living is that there isn't someone with you all the time. Like, you're in your own space, your own apartment. There's someone there 24 hours a day. It's usually kind of like a certified nursing assistant. They don't usually have nurses there 24 hours a day. So if something happens, an emergency, you'll have a way to call for help for someone in the building, but most likely that means you're going to be going to the emergency room to be evaluated. And if someone's having more trouble with mobility or more difficulty with some of those self-care tasks, getting up, getting dressed, getting down to a dining room, you may have to make a move to a higher level of care or bring in more help to stay where you are. So it can be a great place for people for a while, but for many people, we're starting to think about, when do we need more care again, or when do we need to make another transition?
And are there any insurance programs that pay for that level of assisted living?
I keep forgetting to mention this. Yes. Long-term, if you have a long-term care insurance policy, depending on the way your policy is written, it may cover assisted living or a certain amount of the cost of assisted living per day. Medicare does not pay for assisted living, and usually state supported health insurance programs, what in Illinois is called Medicaid, does not cover assisted living. It covers another level of care that's similar to assisted living, but each state is so different, and assisted living is licensed and nursing homes are licensed state by state. So the rules look a little different in each state, and what qualifies for support looks a little different.
And Donna asks us, is there anything that the VA covers or can help with this level of transition to assisted living? Or
so that's a great question. And I am not certain about if the VA covers assisted living. I know that the VA does provide support for nursing homes. But if you want to know definitively, you can call the caregiver support line that the VA has set up. And they would be able to, that's where you can apply for services through the VA or determine if your loved one is eligible for services and kind of start that process. And they can also provide resources about what is in the VA system for resources and support and kind of what programs. So they could answer if the VA covers assisted living.
And can you tell us again
it's the VA caregiver support line. And Mel can share this again after the presentation. I'll get her the resources, but you can Google it. They have a 1-800 number, and they also have a website where you can learn more about their programs.
Super. So when we were talking about assisted living, you talked about sort of a continuum of care, the next level after assisted living, if that's not quite enough and you've had in-home care with assisted living, but that's still not quite enough. Tell us a little bit about what the next level is. Is that called skilled nursing?
It is.
What is
and
that?
So we would be looking at skilled nursing. There's a nurse that's there 24 hours a day, and they're helping you with a lot more of kind of your self-care tasks. So a nurse and aides would be available with the kind of a call button system. They'd help you get up, get to the washroom, get dressed. They'd take you down to your meals. The nurses manage all of your medication and come provide the medication when it's prescribed by the physician. And there's a nurse there 24 hours a day. So in the event that there is a medical need or a medical emergency, the nurses are going to be there to evaluate you. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to need to go to the emergency room to be further evaluated, because a skilled nursing facility is not equipped in the way a hospital is. But at least you're going to have a nurse that's going to be able to evaluate and kind of keep a better idea on, you know, gauge this, what the need might be. And they can catch some of the things earlier. So, you know, urinary tract infections, I imagine Dr. Fleischer has talked about, are, you know, can be really problematic for our population of folks. And if we can catch them early and treat them early, you know, blood work, urine tests, things like that can be done in a skilled nursing facility, and the physician can prescribe a medication. So we might be able to avoid a hospitalization in that way. Skilled nursing facilities are covered by many of the state insurance programs. Medicare does not cover long-term stays in a nursing home. Medicare will cover a short-term stay, what's considered like a rehab stay. So post-hospitalization, you can go to rehab in a nursing facility and stay for up to 100 days, as long as you're meeting criteria for the eligibility. You're not guaranteed the 100 days, but that's the length of benefit. And so that's what Medicare will cover. During a rehab stay, you're getting physical and occupational therapy and some other services that may be appropriate for you. For long-term care in a nursing home, Medicare does not cover that. But like we mentioned earlier, if you have a long-term care insurance policy, that may cover a certain portion each day, depending on how your policy is written. VA benefits do cover long-term stays in certain VA nursing homes, or homes that are affiliated with the VA. Or the state medical insurance programs will also cover long-term care.
Super, super. Somebody is asking us in the chat, if a person can no longer do things for themselves, like getting a snack, turning on the TV or the phone, basic self-care things, is it time for a higher level of care? And I guess the other question is, how do we know when it's time?
Yeah, that's always a difficult thing to navigate. You know, if someone is needing help with things, they're not able to do kind of self-care tasks. So in this example, kind of getting a snack, turning on the TV light, things like that. It makes me wonder if they're also needing help with like going to the washroom or getting dressed or things like that. And so, you know, that might make me think then, you know, do we, depending on kind of anyone's situation, do we want to bring in more help at home or expand the amount of help that we have at home? So how do we know how much help we need? Thinking about when do we need, or like, what are the things we need help with? When do we need that help? And then how much help do we need? And we, as we start to think about that, we might realize like, okay, I need help at this particular time of day. But as things start to change, or as you notice, like, well, that we started with 3 or 4 hours in the morning, but really I'm thinking we need more help. So we're going to bring in help that stays longer, or we're going to shift the time. Like my loved one, I, as a spouse, am able to help my loved one in the morning, but I need to be able to go out. So I'm going to shift the time to the afternoon into the evening. You might play with the amount of time you have someone coming, but if we're concerned about falls, if we're concerned about safety in the home, if we're concerned that maybe our loved one isn't able to get themselves to the washroom, or is getting more impulsive, or is starting to develop some changes with their thinking and memory, that might be a time when we want to reevaluate, what is my current situation? do I need to make some modifications to what that looks like, or do I need to start to explore another level of care?
Yeah. I hear
It's
the
so
question.
hard to know.
I hear the question from our care partners that oftentimes their person is resistant to anybody else besides them doing. And we've talked about that topic with Dr. Fleischer, but maybe you have some insights as well, or stories about people who've had to get through that and get through the guilt of that and how successfully transition somebody else in.
It's so hard. I want to say that at the top. It is such a challenge because you want to honor your loved one's preferences and the guilt that you mentioned, that like when people feel like they should be able to do it, they should be able to do it on their own. In a nursing home, in a hospital, there are shifts of people that provide the care. And the hospital where I work, they work three shifts. And so as a care partner, you're not getting any break. You know, they wouldn't ask a nurse at the hospital to work, I don't know, 24/7 for the next number of years and expect that that nurse is going to be able to keep it up. The nurse wouldn't be able to hack it. It's so much. And so we think about bringing in, like when we think about bringing in help, I was just having a conversation this week. Nope, today's Monday. So last week with a family that was saying, you know, my husband doesn't want help, or I feel guilty bringing it in, or he doesn't really need it. But you as a care partner need it. So we can frame it as, I need help. I need a little bit of help. I've got a lot on my plate right now. And so I'd like to try to have someone come in. So to give myself a little bit of a, you know, allow me to attend to some of the other things that I need to take care of. So sometimes framing it as the caregiver is coming, the like outside caregiver is coming to help the family caregiver, versus I'm bringing in outside help to help you as my loved one with a neurodegenerative illness. Sometimes that can make people more receptive to having care. We also think about trying to do it a little bit earlier than maybe when you think you need it. Because often we realize we're like in the pot of boiling water, but you didn't get thrown in the pot when it was boiling. You like turned it up, and then it got warmer and warmer and warmer and then boiled. And so we don't realize like how much we're doing until we're like on fire. So trying to bring it in a little earlier when things are calmer, when, you know, we recognize that there's going to be an adjustment, when we have a little more capacity to tolerate, like this person is going to do things differently. That's going to be, I'm going to have to get used to having a different person in the house. While uncomfortable, bringing it in a little bit earlier can help. Because then when we really need it, or you've needed it all along, but like when there's been a crisis or something, you've already got the help, and that's not another layer of things you're trying to figure out.
That's a great point. Susan asks us, what about training for me as a care partner? Would an occupational therapist help me learn how to get my person with Parkinson's dressed and showered and all of those things?
They would. That's where home health can be really helpful. They're coming into your house and can help work with you as a care partner. So even physical therapy can help teach you how to transfer, getting someone from one seated situation, like getting them to bed or getting them in and out of the car or something like that. The physical therapist can work with you. And then occupational therapy can, yeah, exactly like Susan was saying, show you how to give them a shower, get them dressed, do other kind of tasks that you're needing help with. Or maybe you had that a couple years ago, your loved one was hospitalized and did a little bit of rehab and you got a little bit in rehab, but your loved one's situation has changed in the last couple of years and they're not able to help you in the same way that they used to. You can have home health come again and get just like a refresher, exactly, of like, okay, here's where we stand now. How do I do it? How do I do it this way?
We are also asked the question, what if I don't need care every week? I just need it as needed so I can go to an appointment. And is it possible to set up care on an ad hoc basis?
It is. It can be. So here are a few things I think about with that. Going through an agency since COVID has become a little bit more of a challenge because many, not all, but many of the agencies have, say we need you to commit to a certain number of hours, a certain number of days, in order for our caregivers to come, if you have us on a routine basis. Otherwise, we can't necessarily guarantee we'll be able to provide the care. Now, that's not all of them. So I would certainly, if there's agencies you've in your area, call and ask and see if they can help accommodate. Another way to find care might be through word of mouth. So your neighbor had a caregiver that came and helped them and they loved them. They thought they were great. After they had had a surgery, they don't need them anymore, but they would recommend them. So maybe you call that person's caregiver and say, hey, would you be occasionally a couple times a month, I need a little bit of help. Would you be willing to, come sit with my loved one so I can go to my doctor's appointment or go to lunch with my girlfriends or go to my another young family member's grandchild, some kind of important event I want to be able to participate in. You see if that caregiver is available. Faith communities are really a great way to find kind of word of mouth caregivers as well. You might not know that individual personally, but you know someone else in the community that knows them. Other social connect, networks in the community, or other family or friends, your adult child has a friend whose loved one has, your cousin's niece, whatever. Those are great ways to find people. And the connection to you, you wouldn't believe the different ways people find these caregivers. But it can help people feel more comfortable about bringing someone in. Well, they know someone that I know. That person can vouch for them. I feel more comfortable. And those people can tend to be more flexible. So exactly to the point, this way you get to find a couple people. That way, if the first one's not available, reach out to the other one. You can even ask them, do you know other people? If you're not available, are there anyone else that you might recommend that I reach out to? Because it's important people get out.
It is really important. And take care of your own healthcare issues or your social needs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pat asks, they say, sounds like memory care is more like help for general cognitive challenges. Could you define what memory care realistically is?
Yes. Memory care can either be offered in assisted living. So there's many assisted living memory care facilities or kind of areas. Memory care can also be offered in skilled nursing. So memory care means or is intended to mean that there's an additional support and training by the staff to recognize how changes in thinking and memory can impact someone's behavior or how we approach someone to, invite them to a meal or invite them to an activity or get them to, take a shower. That being said, memory care is kind of a general sort of approach to memory. So, or changes in thinking and memory, there isn't always the nuance of Alzheimer's disease dementia versus Parkinson's disease dementia. And kind of, so you're probably not, if you find it, it's a unicorn and spread the word. There are not a lot of memory care facilities that are specific for Parkinson's disease dementia or its cousin Lewy body dementia. But that being said, if you find one that you tour, you like the staff, you like the facility, you like the way that, you know, the nurses and aides respond, that they're consistent, like you get a good feeling, you do your research, then you as the expert of your loved one can train them to the specific situation and needs of your loved one. So I would say that you know, there's a lot of resources out there that you can provide a facility and say, here's my loved one's individual situation. Here's some more reading about kind of the broader type of memory changes that they're experiencing, and work with them to educate them specifically on your needs.
Tracy asks us a question, and I'm sure others are thinking the same thing. Who can you talk to help with these decisions? You know, who are these people who help families navigate this system?
Yeah. There's a lot of different types of people that can help you think it through. Social workers like myself may be embedded in your physician's clinic. So I'm part of the Movement Disorders Clinic at Rush, but there's a network of social workers across the hospital system in primary care, in other specialties that are available. But if you're not at I recognize I'm in an academic center. If you're not at an academic center, there are lots of social workers in the community. So like I mentioned earlier, the area agencies on aging, kind of your senior centers, the different senior kind of state programs are full of social workers. You can get connected to social workers or geriatricians that way. The local community hospital likely has a social worker. The senior center in your area, they will probably have a social worker, or they'll be able to recommend kind of who else to talk to. You can talk to elder care managers who you might have. Some of them, there is a fee, but they can help you think through or kind of come into the situation, get a better handle on kind of what's going on, and help you kind of think through some of these things as well. There's social workers that are embedded in the community-based palliative care programs. There's social workers that are connected to that physician-ordered home health program. They have social workers as well. You can find a therapist who might be a social worker. Many, many mental health professionals happen to also be social workers. And while you may be seeing them for a therapy need related to kind of mental health or the responsibility of being a care partner, they also are social workers. And if they're not able to, they may also be able to say, here, I know this person is connected to this agency. Why don't you reach out to them? So we're in disguise all over. It's kind of just trying to find us. And so hopefully that gives you some ideas. The VA too. If you're connected to the VA, the VA has social workers embedded as well. So
if you live where there's a regional or independent Parkinson's organization, oftentimes they'll have social workers on staff that really understand Parkinson's.
Yes.
And can connect you to resources in your community as well.
Yes.
The larger Parkinson's organizations have finders, locators for social workers as well.
Some of the larger Parkinson's organizations have like staff in particular regions as well. So again, it's not perfect, but there's ways that some of those larger organizations can still try to help connect to you on a more local level.
Yeah, super. This hour has flown by. Is there anything, Sarah, that you were hoping we'd touch on that we didn't get to today that would be a takeaway for our community? Or
I wish we had more time, because I think we could talk about this for so long. There are lots. I'll share some of these with you guys so that you can spread the word. There's also, if you want to learn more, there's other resources that you can learn more about specific things. So International Neural Palliative Care Society, if you want to learn more about palliative care, you know, finding a specific thing, you can learn more about resources and watch recorded webinars and things like this. There's so many of these things out there. I know it's hard to find them or find more resources, but I recorded one that I'll share as well of just kind of piecing together community resources that's also available on the International Neuropalliative Care website. It just launched. So to kind of give you a little more about how you navigate community resources.
Wonderful. Well, once again, thank you so much for your work in this community and for sharing it with us. Sarah, thank you so much for being here. Audience, thank you for tuning in today, and we will see you back on Friday.
Thank you.